This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network Jewish Studies channel. I'm your host, Rora Russi, Executive Director of the Unity Through Diversity Institute, where we explore the future of our heritage. Today, we're really delighted to speak with Dr. Debbie Corin about her book, Responsa in a Historical Context, a view of post-expulsion Spanish-Portuguese Jewish communities through 16th and 17th century Responsa, published by Academic Studies Press in 2024. The book is a winner of an AJS Jordan Schnitzer First Publication Award and a Wojcicki Book Publishing Grant. Welcome, Dr. Corin, and thank you for joining us here today. So we usually start by asking our authors to tell us a little bit about themselves and their areas of research, but I think yours is even a little more interesting because you're a doctor of mathematics who's taught Talmud and Halakha. So can you give us a little bit of a background explanation for that?
Okay. So I've worn many hats in my life. I've taught math at the college level before switching to working in high tech, specifically the computer networking field. I also taught computer networking at the university level. But parallel to my professional track, I always had an interest in Jewish studies, wanting to understand the whys, the halachic process and development. I was largely an autodidact. But when I came to Israel, I found many more opportunities for various classes in different settings. After reducing my workload in high tech, I decided I wanted a formal academic degree, and I received a master's degree in Talmud and Halakha at the Schechter Institute in Jerusalem. Most of the teaching in Talmud and Halakha was in informal settings, only here and there and something formal. Classes that I held in my house, and usually with my own twist, my own insights that I enjoy doing. I love sharing my knowledge in Jewish studies, accumulated over many years in many ways, and I love sharing it with other people and provoking people to think sometimes a little differently about what we're typically taught. I always taught, whether it was math, computer networking, I could even say back in high school, I was a math tutor. So I've always taught, and I like to share my knowledge, as I said. So that's the connection, just to say about what a maybe strange, maybe not strange combination, the math and the Talmud and Halakha. Recently, somebody had commented when he looked afterwards what else I've published, he commented and said, I know very few people, if any, who know both what a MIB is and a Rishon. A MIB is a management information base, something from quite a while ago in the computer networking field. So, yeah.
I'm glad you said it because I wasn't sure what a MIB was.
No, I actually, and if you're younger than a certain age, you wouldn't because, as it turns out, those protocols in computer networking aren't used, but that's another topic for another podcast.
And so you definitely brought up some, you definitely provoked thinking in this book and have a lot of topics that we can expand upon and we will talk about. But before we go there, I want to make sure that everybody in our audience understands some of the basic terms that in the title of the book. You say that it's based on responsa. Can you just explain a little bit what a responsa is?
Okay, so in Hebrew, we call them she'elot u'tshuvot. Responsa really means just the response, but in Hebrew, it's a question and a response. It's usually abbreviated as shut, shin vav tav, she'elot u'tshuvot, and the plural of them becomes shitim, which is a little bit funny, but that's the way things in Hebrew sometimes work. This is questions that are posed to poskim, adjudicators, and usually the ones that we find in literature, printed originally in manuscripts, are from higher level authorities, response or not, what sometimes people, if they go ask a local rabbi a question that actually he knows these things by heart from studying in yeshiva, or he knows where to look. And if it's an open shut case, you look in the Shulchan Aruch, that's not the sponsor. It's also not really these days, some people look at the things on the internet, right? They ask some question to a rabbi and basically the answer consists of, it is forbidden. So that's not response. Or maybe they give a two-sentence answer. I'm being a little bit...
We're following you. That's okay.
But we find a lot of that on the internet. That's not really responsa. Responsa are detailed, argued cases that have not yet... There's something about them that they're not just easily say, we can look at this precedent. Historically, we can say, and people do say, in fact, there's an excellent book, it's in Hebrew, I don't know if it's been translated to English, by Shmuel Glick on response literature. And we could start out and say some of the questions raised in the Talmud are really that type of case, a question with an argued response. But typically we look at response literature, something that started in the time of the Gibeonim, where questions might have been sent from all throughout Jewish communities. They managed, as slow as communications were and as difficult it was to get something from a far-flung Jewish community in those days to Babylonia, they did. It could take months, but they did, and responses were written. And we have a lot. We clearly can't know what we don't have, but we do have material from that time. I could be playful and say the first shoot or responsum is in the Torah when the daughters of Tzlofchad come with a case to Moshe. It was Moshe and Elazar HaKohen, and there were other, you know, the important, it said the Nisi'im. I'm not sure exactly how we want to translate that, but they were clearly the top type people. And they came with a claim because the precedent so far, the law was so new, but there was no precedent or no law that was stated about the case of a deceased who had daughters. And so they came and asked a question. And Moshe too turned to a higher authority. He didn't send it to another rabbi, he asked God. So I could be playful and say that's the first response.
Right. It's kind of hard to build on precedent at that point. So I think one of the things that's in the response are the proof texts that are brought in and the sources from around. So we can go a little later. But basically what you did in this book is you took eight translations of responsa.
No, I didn't take translations. I didn't take eight translations.
Correct. Yes. You gave us translations. Thank you. For eight responsa, and you gave us the original Hebrew as well. And you also provided the halakhic and historical or cultural context for these responsa. And let's start just by saying, how did you pick these eight?
Well, I ended up, I started working with responsa in the Schechter Institute. I had a lot of courses in responsa, and I enjoyed them very much. And after I finished my degree there, I ended up really more for the interest than for the pay, because again, I was used to high tech, not the academic world. I was a research assistant for a Jewish history professor who wanted some response translated and annotated. And that's how I found that I really do enjoy doing this and find it fascinating. I didn't yet then. He wanted a particular period in history, but in the course of it, I realized that I had an interest in the period of history that I chose, post-expulsion Sephardic communities. Part of the reason is because I think those rabbis wrote beautifully. Their Hebrew was beautiful. their weaving in of language from the Bible is, it's magnificent. It's a puzzle because as I read them, I mean, in fact, one of my prime readers, I guess my spouse, he asked, how did you know that this is from the book of Daniel? How did you know that this is? And yeah, I don't know the Bible that well, but there's something in the language that has that, you know, a poetic turn, a something, a flavor, I'd say, this must be something he's taking, a phrase he's taking from the Tanakh. Of course, these days we're so fortunate because we have databases and we can search these things easily, or we have a concordance that makes it pretty easy. And so I'd say, oh yeah, this really is from the Tanakh. And there are times I was wrong, but and I hope I didn't miss too many. Sometimes I felt like I'm checking every word. But anyway, I find that I really appreciate the way these people wrote. And I ended up focusing, and the history, of course, is fascinating. I ended up focusing on this period in time. Once I do that, I'm able to, again, with the help of excellent tools that we have, like the Bar Ilan Responsa Project. We also have scanned books by the gazillions at Otsar HaChochma, but it's the Responsa, the Bar Ilan Responsa, that allowed me that very good search engine, and I was able to, first of all, limit to those respondents or poskim from the time period that I wanted, the locations that I wanted, although there is one that's unusual because it's sent from a community in Amsterdam to the Bach, Rabbi Joel Sirkis, who was in Lithuania. I talk about how that happened. But so I was able to limit my search to certain respondents, and then I have certain keywords, just look for Portugal, look for anusim, which means forced ones, and look for certain terms and phrases that would pick out responses. I did read through loads and loads of them because I wanted to find ones that the halakhic theme, I wanted to vary the halakhic themes. One is about inheritance, one about divorce, one about lawsuit with a claim in the taxes chapter. The Venetian Inquisition, of course, is a fascinating one. And so I wanted to have a variety. And so between searching with search engines and reading a lot, I ended up selecting the selection that I have.
And you said you specifically wanted to focus on the Sfardim from that time period. What's unique about that? I mean, we know, like you said, the beautiful language, I think, is something that anybody who touches upon this time period knows, the language, the songs. People are talking about the recipes quite a bit today. But there's this deep philosophical and rabbinic tradition that grew out of there. What do you find fascinating, or what was your impetus to focus on that?
I don't know if it's an impetus, but what I really think is one of the values, and I really, really like to emphasize, I partly in trying to see to whom should I send information about this book at academic departments and universities with Jewish studies departments throughout the United States, there is very little about Sephardic studies, but very little about Sephardic studies and Sephardic history. There here and there are some courses in Ladino. I too took a course in Ladino at university, but I ended up not selecting any responsa that had Ladino in there. There just virtually isn't anything that touches this intellectual side of Sephardic culture. The recipes are great. You know, the food's delicious. The songs are lovely. I also sing a couple of these tunes next, you know, with the Seder, I'll be singing a couple of Ladino tunes. Lovely. But it is really a shame that this side of the culture, the intellectual side, is something that people are just not familiar with. And people who are Sephardic themselves are not familiar with it. And it is clear that once upon a time, it wasn't so accessible to typical people. But these days, it's more accessible. And that was what I view as one of the main tasks in this book, the main things that I accomplished, to make this material accessible to anyone who wants to engage with it. I translate, you know, if you don't know the Hebrew or Aramaic, or even if you do, there are things that are very, very tricky there without that little assistance of an explanation that you might not get. And you won't necessarily get without doing a lot of work like I did, all the biblical language that's in the text, the arguments. And so I make that accessible. I make it accessible by giving halachic background. And I'm really hoping, whether it's in university departments, maybe somebody who teaches Sephardic history, teaches at the period of the expulsion, would use one chapter as some kind of example, historic resource, as well as sample of the literature of the time.
And that's one of the things in the book, is that you give the halachic background, you give the, like you said, the biblical quotes, where they're from, so it helps put it into context, but you also make it applicable to today, and you ask discussion questions, I think, that are also important. What did you find that was most interesting or telling when you were trying to create the applications for today?
A lot of the topics, I mean, they're relevant to Jewish life today. Sadly, the problems of divorce, and I, you know, you might want to touch on that separately, but problems of divorce, problems of women who cannot get a divorce, right? Agunot, today we typically, or people typically think of Agunot as getra, the problem of get refusal, but of course, it used to more be the case as well, although get refusal was always, always a problem. The problem of women not knowing where their husbands are, whether they purposely abandoned their wives or whether they disappeared, war disappeared at sea. And there are problems that result from this. And these problems existed then, but they still exist now. Tragically, as far as what happened this past October 7th, we don't yet know. And there might be cases of women whose status will then have to be decided by a Beit Din. So this is an issue, and so it is relevant today. Other topics have a relevance today. Secular studies, it has a relevance today in the religious environment. And we can look at almost any one of what I have there, the last chapter, which relates to a question, that's the one from the New World, that relates to a question about, well, now we're in the Southern Hemisphere, do we still say the prayer for rain at the same time that we would in the Northern Hemisphere, since everything is topsy-turvy? I end up asking questions about how can you have the kind of kavanah, the kind of intent feeling when you pray, if you are being told you're supposed to say a text that doesn't really relate to where you're living. So isn't there a conflict there? I think these are questions that people can ask today, right? A lot of people, they say their prayers and kind of just mumble through them. And maybe you need to think about the text you're saying. So there are some questions raised there that can provoke thought. That goes back to the fact that I like to provoke thought. I like people to not just take things at face value or the way they're always told, but to think about.
So on that note, let's try to dive into at least some of the response. So we're not going to get into all eight, but I want to start with the fourth one, because I also like history. So it was written fairly soon after the expulsion. I'm giving the context a little, if you'll allow me. A married couple moved away in order to maintain their Jewish practices, but they left two sons in Portugal who had converted rather than be exiled. And so now it becomes an international discussion when the father, the patriarch, is dying, and he is living openly as a Jew in Ottoman lands. And he writes a will whereby only those of his three sons that agree to live Christian lands and live openly as a Jew will inherit. So I just, there was so much here to unpack, but can you just give us a little bit of an appetite, the highlights so that maybe we can whet the appetites of our listeners to go deeper.
Right. So as you said, there are three sons. Only one of them has left the Christian lands and is practicing as a Jew. One of them did come and join the family, it seems briefly, we really can't tell exactly for how long, but returned to live in a Christian land, whether Spain or Portugal, we don't know. And it really doesn't matter. And one never came, yet. So we say yet, or I say yet, because that's an important point that's made, that so long as he hasn't come yet, there was still a chance that he might return to Judaism. But the one who did come briefly, and he didn't have himself circumcised when he came, and he went back to where he was from, he basically reneged on his father's requirement. He made it clear, I came, I'm not returning to Judaism, and he left. So here's the, the really particularly interesting part, maybe the soap opera-ish part in the story. The loss, it's a lawsuit. The plaintiff is the son who was practicing as a Jew. And the defendant is his mother. Because while that son who came and returned to the Christian land, she gave him his portion, which was supposed to be an escrow of the father's bequest. She wasn't supposed to. And in the father's will, it is the legitimate heirs, those who have returned to Judaism according to his wishes, that would then be entitled. And so the practicing Jew says, what you gave my brother is really mine. And so he's suing his mother. I think Families Divided is a good name for a story like that.
And again, there's so much that can parallel to today, but we definitely won't get into that right now because we want to go further. So you mentioned Venice and how it has an interesting place within the history of the Inquisition. So the sixth responsum is one that touches upon Jewish law, ethics, moral questions through this Jew in Venice who informed on others. So the focus here, rather than family, is on an informant. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Okay, so you said a Jew in Venice, and actually the character is an interesting character because he seems to really flip-flop. It really is not clear what his identity is. I talk about that too, maybe sometimes use people who basically migrate back and forth. Maybe it's for convenience. Maybe it's because they're not sure what they believe. It's a phenomenon. And yes, he is caught as somebody who at least Judaizes. Judaizes are people who are either act like they're Christian, pretend to be Christian, but nevertheless maintain some Jewish practices accused by the Inquisition. It seems that, although some people would like to think that the accusations are false accusations, it's people who just have some gripe against someone and they inform, there certainly are cases like that, but it seems that this person was Judaizing and he was outside the ghetto. And that's the no-no. An important note is that the Venetian Inquisition is very different from what people are much more familiar with, the Spanish Inquisition. It was not forbidden to be a Jew in Venice. There were Jews in Venice from way before the Spanish Inquisition, before the Spanish expulsion. There are Jews in Venice from hundreds of years before, actually, because there were Jews who were in the Roman Empire. And the only requirement at that time is that Jews stayed or lived within the ghetto. It was prohibited to be a baptized Christian who returned to Judaism. But there were baptized Christians who returned to Judaism, who basically they came from Spain, Portugal, and other places, and they went to the ghetto. And if they didn't leave the ghetto, they weren't found out, and they weren't bothered by the authorities. The Venetian government, I guess you could call it, did not go search for those people. But this character, and I'll give him his name, Filippo Denise, and that's what makes the case so very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
He ventured out of the ghetto. Not only did he venture out of the ghetto, but there were a hat. You wore a hat if you're one color, if you're a Christian, and a different color if you're a Jew. And he wore a Christian hat. And he said he did that because it was better for business. Well, makes sense. But nevertheless, he got caught. So when that happened, he did at some point, not under torture. Torture was pretty rare, actually, again, in the Venetian Inquisition. He did inform on the person who circumcised him because it was revealed. They sent people to check him. He had scar tissue that indicated he was not circumcised as a baby, as he first claimed. He was circumcised as an adult, and he informed on the person who did it. So the case here, the plaintiff, is this Moel. And he is now not in Venice anymore. He had to flee Venice because a death warrant was issued for him. Because circumcising a baptized Christian, that's a real no-no. And so he had to flee. Therefore, he is suing for his loss of income, for his loss of his livelihood, for all the expenses that it cost him to leave Venice and end up probably in Salonika, but certainly somewhere under Ottoman rule. How do we know it's Filippo Denise? And that's what makes this case really so interesting, because serendipity, that's another, let's say, lengthy process, how I ended up finding that this case is in the processi, which are the records of the Venetian Inquisition, written in mostly a Venetian dialect of Italian and some Latin. I did have some assistance in translating that because there's a limit to what I
can do. With your many languages, that's not one of them. That's okay.
Oh, I don't have that many languages, but no, that's not one of them. Although it's amazing how much you could even do with Google Translate. But I did have assistance with that. And his case is in there. And how do we know it's his case? The details. There were details about his nephew, about two Mohalim, about all sorts of things are so close, so parallel to what's in the question in this response. That is clear, it is exactly the same case. And so the person in the Venetian records is Filippo Denise. And Filippo Denise was eventually, according to the records, he repented, became a good Christian, and some priest testifies that he's now attending mass, whatever, and therefore, he basically is free for a while. He was confined to Venice, and he has all sorts of things that are imposed on him, having to say so many prayers and so many masses and whatever was required of him to repent. He did. He was a good boy, and he's now a good Christian. Several historians who are historians of that era were familiar with this case from the Venetian records. And because there's another record, a deed that he signed, or that his name is there, a deed for a particular property, they conclude that Filippo Denise ended up being a good Christian in Venice, or at least a well-behaved Christian, let's say, in Venice. But the Maharshaf knows otherwise, because here he shows up. He doesn't know, or he doesn't name the name Filippo Denise, but here he shows up in a case. Somebody's bringing a case against him, and not in this. And I'll just quote from the end of what the Maharshaf says that I jotted down here for myself. He says, I would say that apparently from the question, the cited betrayer is now located beyond the place where his forced conversion occurred, and he has returned to the true and just faith. Because if this were not so, what would be the sense to this question? For if he were still an apostate, for what purpose would it serve to know that the Jewish law requires that he pays damages? Okay, it would make no sense to bring his case to a Beit Din, to a Jewish religious court. And so the Mahashach tells us something that the historians didn't know. He didn't stay a great Christian. He got out when he could. And he joined, he actually had family in Salonika. And so we can assume that Salonika is where he is. Certainly the Mahashach was in Salonika. And so we can assume that Filippo Denis, in the end, whether he wanted to die as a Jew, whether he, because his sons ended up leaving, his nephew, he had family that did leave. We don't really know what made him flip back to being a Jew, but it seems he did.
Right, and it could be that the historians didn't know the response.
No, they didn't know this response. That's the thing. They didn't know this response. They looked at the historical records, but they didn't know this. And as I said, it's serendipity that I was able to connect the two together.
That's some of the amazing things in the book. But again, we're just touching upon some things. So I want to touch upon, you mentioned the Aguna. And so we're going back to the first responsum at this point. So an Aguna, or a chained woman. And today, like you said, it's a very hot button topic with the people who refuse to give the divorce, usually the male who refuses to give the divorce. And then, so there's the concept of a conditional divorce. Can you talk a little bit about the concept of a conditional divorce?
The conditional divorce is something that was actually used much more often in the past. It was used not just to avoid, it was used not really to avoid problems of get refused, because if the guy is the type of guy that's going to refuse to give a get, he's also going to refuse to give a conditional get. That's why the chapter was called Get Out or Divorce Out of Love, because the men who would give a conditional divorce are men who truly cared about their wives. They were traveling overseas. They were going to war. They were going to be on some long business trip. Jews were very frequently merchants, traveling merchants. So that's how things worked in those days. And a man that really cared about his wife did not want to leave his wife, a chained woman. And so he would give or send. In this case, it was sent. And yes, in many cases, somebody, in fact, the tractate Gittin starts out with a get being sent. So a get would be sent. You would send it with some kind of messengers. And the idea is this get is effective from now, if I don't return by such and such a date. That's what makes it conditional. So it, in a way, it becomes retroactive, because if I say this get is effective now, April, what are we?
16.
April 16th, right, sorry. It is effective April 16th if I don't return by April 30th. It means April 30th comes and goes, and whoa, he didn't return. I'm not divorced April 30th. I'm retroactively divorced from April 16th. The reason we do it that way, not we, but it was done that way, is so that if he dies in the interim, she's divorced before he might die. And what's the value of being divorced versus dying? In some cases, it's very important. It could be very important if there are no children and he has a brother, because then you have the problem of levirate marriage. And that's another problem, okay, which you can also basically be an aguna if the brother-in-law refuses to either do chalitza, which is a release, or marry. So these conditional divorces were used for that purpose. They were used in World War II. And There were rabbis at troop ships pleading with Jewish servicemen, sign these before you go. I bring a number of sources. I cite a particular article that people could read and discuss why it is not used as much today. It is not used as much today. That's a fact. There are some individual cases of men who will go to a rabbi and ask they arrange this, but it's not an individual case. It is not done the way it was in World War II, where it was publicly called for and tried. It's not that all Jewish servicemen did this by any means, but there really was an attempt to convince men to do this.
So like you said, the woman in this response happens to have lost her writ of divorce, but I'm going to let other people read that because I want to make sure we touch upon a few more, maybe one or two more with your permission. So there's just another hot button topic in the third response, because especially today with the whole concept of people wanting to sit in yeshiva all day, or at a lot of political issues with learning secular studies. And in the book, and I'm quoting it on page 98, the Zkan Aharon says, or in your translation, he says, I also say about this offender, his complaint is not only about Simeon, but about the saints that are on earth. So clearly he slandered the Gaonim and the Rishonim who engaged themselves with worldly wisdom, such as Rabbi Sadia Gaon and Rabbi Chaigon and those sages after them, such as Ibn Gabirol and Rabbi Yehuda Levi, Rabbi Ibn Ezra and Maimonides and scholars of every generation who built a magnificent lower. Explain that a little bit, please. I was just very moved by it, and I think it's important to talk about it.
It's beautiful. And the whole response does a wonderful job. He basically gives us a survey, in a sense. If somebody wanted a survey of, let's say, up until his time, or not quite up until his time, of sages in the Talmud, early Jewish scholars who had worldly knowledge clearly of what was available at that time, right? Science at that time, or philosophy as it was called, because philosophy actually included natural sciences, physical sciences, astronomy. They knew these things, they studied these things. In some cases, these people also were poets. They wrote. They did not just focus themselves on Talmudic studies. And it's just beautiful, the whole response, it was just beautiful to see how he tells us various stories in the Talmud so that we know that so-and-so was a physician and so-and-so knew astronomy. And along the way, of course, these stories are delightful. And then you can use them as references and go read these stories even more in the Talmud itself, and they're delightful stories. So it's a wonderful listing. It is clear that he himself is quite well-versed in what these people knew. And I'm not just talking, of course, he's well-versed in what people in the Talmud did, but he's also well-versed in what other people in generations preceding him knew. It is very relevant. In many ways, amazingly relevant, because the question there really is, how literally do we take the sentence that the Hagita bo yomam v'layla, you study day and night, how literally do we take that? And it is clear from this response, and there is no need to take that so literally. It is very relevant, and any of those listeners to this podcast in New York, I refer you to YAFED. If you're not familiar with it, it's an organization that lobbies for the rights of Haredi children to have a proper education. I refer you to New York State Department of Education trying to enforce a minimum secular curriculum in the Hasidic schools, written about a lot in the New York Times and other media. And of course, anyone who lives in Israel knows that governments in this country can fall because of an attempt to insist that in the Haredi schools, they teach a core curriculum. So And it's not just in these countries, it's in other countries, it's in the UK, and it's not just in Jewish communities. In the UK, they're very concerned about other religious schools that do not teach a proper secular curriculum. So it is a real issue today. And the discussion here, and the discussion and the response, and, well, it's very, very relevant.
And I think it's relevant also the people that he's bringing up here. You're talking about Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, you're talking about Maimonides. I mean, these are known philosophers, but scientists, we would call them, right? I mean, these are, also all of them are poets and in literature and very into Arabic literature as well. So it's an important point that I wanted to focus on a little bit. I encourage everyone to read the Amsterdam and the Brazil and the other ones, but I don't want to get into them because I want you to leave us with one note. I don't want to be the one to pick the one note to close out this conversation. If you could leave us with one thought about the importance or significance of these responsa and their context. I know it's a big question, but I think it's important to at least.
Yeah, and that's why I hesitate for a moment. But first of all, I would like to go back and just emphasize particularly the aspect for Sephardic intellectual tradition. Sephardic intellectual, it's an amazing inheritance. We use inheritance that we have to have this literature and encourage people, particularly people in Sephardic communities, delve in, try to do it. I think you can. I made it as accessible as possible. In general, the significance, I think, is this literature can offer us so much. And I can say that I did a very thorough literature search to see what other books might do something similar to what I did. And I could not find any. If anybody knows one, let me know. And then if there's a second edition, I'll put it in the footnote. But I have in a footnote in the introduction a long list of books that they might have translations of the questions and a 2-3 sentence summary of the response. They might have just summaries of the response. There are books that talk about what we can historically learn from the responsa, a lot of them, and there are some people who specialize in that, whose whole field of historic research is that. But they don't really teach us how to read these responsa. There are all sorts of angles in books with responsa, but as far as I could find, there is no one. There's someone, for example, she particularly picked responsa with Ladino in them and focuses on the Ladino language in these responsa, and she translates the Ladino portions and portions of the responsa. But again, it's not a discussion of understanding the halachic basis, the halachic arguments, together with historic background. I haven't found anything that does that. I think it really is significant. I think that this material could be used, whether in history courses, in academic settings. It can be used in courses in Jewish institution-type settings, right? And yeshivot or let's say, more modern religious-type institutions where you want to teach a halachic concept, the concept of asmachta. Whether an agreement is actually binding or not is very complicated. And I think the presentation here and the example of its discussion is a very good way to look at it. I even bring in the Merchant of Venice as an example for that. So I think it can be used in those sorts of settings. I think that it's significant because I hope that I'm opening up a world that is being made more accessible to a wide variety of readers.
And I think one of the things about the Sephardi viewpoint, and like you were saying, it is bringing in the different thoughts, not only the Jewish text, but bringing in the Merchant of Venice, I think was a very Sephardi thing to do. thank you. This is a wonderful glimpse into the post-Iberian expulsion Jewish world and something that we can continue to talk about today. And if I may add, I think it would be great for a debate class also. It has a great place for a debate to start here, and I think it's a wonderful start there. So we look forward to hearing from you more and to discussing this more, because there is definitely much more to discuss. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Dr. Debbie Corin about her book, Responsa in a Historical Context, A View of Post-Expulsion Spanish-Portuguese Jewish Communities Through 16th and 17th Century Responsa, published by Academic Studies Press in 2024. And it has been a true pleasure to continue exploring the diversity of the Jewish world, of the Jewish people. Follow Jewish Unity Through Diversity Institute on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, and our podcast, Reclaiming Identity, where we talk a lot about the Sephardic experience. Thank you.